Yep.
Thanks very much. So our passage is from Mark 12 this morning, and it's part of a series about gossiping the gospel. And the title this morning is, Why Is It Not Easy? And I have to say that sort of trying to put the title and the passage together has been really a very difficult sort of, you know, needs a bit of sort of what my old maths teacher used to talk about, skill and low cunning. You know, you're not quite sure about how it's all going to fit together. And, you know, it would have been fun to have gotten the parable that John got last week, you know, about the sower. He just reaches in his bag and he flings it out and it goes anywhere and everywhere. And some of it's productive and some of it isn't. But this time we've got a different agrarian parable to look at. And it's a parable about some tenants. And they want something. What do they want? They want a vineyard. Why do they want it? We don't know. That's not explained. The parables, that's the thing about the parables. Jesus sets up these stories, but he doesn't tell you everything that's going on in the story. Maybe it's that they wanted the sort of free wine for the rest of their lives. Maybe it's that they wanted to run their own show. I don't know what it was, but for some reason, they want the vineyard. They're paying a rent on the vineyard in terms of, actually it's not a rent in terms of what we think of as a rent, it's a rent in the sense that they give part of what comes out of the vineyard back to the vineyard owner. They're not paying a monthly rent or whatever. And how are they going to get it? And this is the bit where sort of the logic of the parable sort of diverts away from anything that most people would have seen in their lives. Because their first plan is they're going to beat up anybody who comes looking for the rent. So when the rent people arrive, their reaction is to beat them up, and that way they can hang on to the proceeds of their work over the year. And then eventually they come up with another plan. They've beaten up enough of these people, and they still kept coming, but the last one, unfortunately, they've killed. And so the vineyard owner's logic is, again, a strange logic. And he says, I will send my son. He'd only one left to send, a son whom he loved. And he says, maybe they'll negotiate with him. Maybe they'll talk to him. And they get a completely different idea. They say, look, this is the heir. If we kill the heir, we become the inheritors of the vineyard. And so we'll get it as an inheritance. And of course, this completely lopsided logic has people gasping. If you read Luke's narrative of this parable, people sort of at the end of it, when they've heard what's been said, they're so shocked. They just say, God forbid, and I guess they would have muttered sort of holy things and sort of turned around and disappeared. What is this parable about? The reaction here in Mark by the chief priests and the teachers of the law is that they see that somehow Jesus has told this parable against them. And they don't quite, I don't think from the way that it's expressed, I don't think they quite understand what it is that Jesus has said, but they're quite convinced that Jesus has gotten a story over on them, but they're afraid to do something. And the topic today is gossiping the gospel. How are we going to share a story based on this? I was chatting to Andy earlier this week about the series, and he said, Terry, he said, you know, if there is a time when you think that the passage and the talk title don't work, he said, you're free to change it. And I said, well, yeah, I know. But it's quite fun to treat it as a puzzle and to try and work out how you fit the two things together. What was going on in the mind of whoever put the plan together? And I guess that the parable for us raises two questions that apply to the people around us. They apply to our lives as well. And the number one thing is, do people know what they want? And the second question is, are they trying to go the right way about getting it? And I think that those two questions are very deeply buried in this parable. What is it we really want? How are we really trying to get that? And another thing, when I was talking to Andy earlier on, before we talked about the individual thing, was the series as a whole. And one of the things he was saying was, I hope that at some stage, we'll spend some time in these talks actually talking about what the gospel is. Because the gospel can be a little bit like Mornington Crescent, where every speaker assumes that everybody knows the rules and nobody ever explains what's really going on in the gospel. And so here's a few minutes just looking very quickly at what the gospel message is about. It's a particular way. It's very hard, you know, in 2 or 3 minutes to explain everything to everybody's satisfaction. And I'm sure lots of you will come up to me afterwards and say, Terry, but you missed out this important bit, or you missed out that important bit. But it goes something like this. This is what Christians have believed for 2,000 years. Everybody wants something. That's where the parable starts. It starts with a group of people who want something in life. They want the vineyard. Everybody wants something. Sometimes it's security. Sometimes it's happiness. Sometimes it's to be loved. Sometimes it's freedom from guilt. Sometimes it's a sense of purpose. Sometimes it is managing, having meaning in our lives. We're looking for something. And we go about it in different ways. Sometimes we go about it by trying to make money. Sometimes we try to buy things. Sometimes we seek it in sex. Sometimes we seek it in building things, putting things up, perhaps in writing things, perhaps in doing things. And you could probably add 6 or 7 other items to that list without having to think too long. We all want something, and we go after it in different ways. And these topics are pretty hot in our society at the moment. And it doesn't really matter what you think of those topics, what your view is on any one of those topics. I think everybody that's ever commented on these things will say that there's a context in which each of those can be rewarding and can be deeply fulfilling. And yet, if we try to make any one of them the purpose of our life, if we try and build purpose around that, something goes wrong. And the world, the papers are full of things that have gone wrong as people have tried to make sex the center, as people have tried to make making money the center, as people have tried to make building things or even doing things the center of their lives. Sooner or later, doing doesn't fulfill what it once did. And that's one of the two problems that people face. If you want to run a vineyard, if that's what your goal in life is, the first problem you'll face from an experiential point of view is that it doesn't work for long. It doesn't give that sense of purpose, that sense of fulfillment for long. And of course, the wealthier we are, the more access we have to funds, the longer we can put off that moment of discovering, as some guy said, or some executive said, on the day he retired, I didn't realize that the ladder I was climbing was leaning against the wrong wall. Sometimes it can take us a long time to realize that the things that we're putting our effort into are not really bringing us what we want. And the Christian message is that there's another fundamental problem with that approach. And that is that everything we try offends the one person who can help us, and that's God. Now, our society is big on offense at the moment. In fact, the whole question about offense is probably the strongest connection that our society has with this particular passage. We are used to people being offended. We've created, you know, whole electronic sectors where the role of most people seems to be taking offense and then saying rude things back to people who have offended them. We're a society that understands offense. And we understand that offense is not about logic. We understand that offense is about how the individual feels about it. And what the Bible has to say is that God is offended about a lot of what he sees, about the way that we've been going. Probably the thing underneath it that offends God most is the fact that we want to run our own show. But that's my sort of working out of what it is that fundamentally offends God. But the message is that God is offended. And for that reason, there's a sort of an edge to the gospel that is difficult. Now, not all of the parables explain that offense. This parable actually explains the offense. Jesus has set up a ridiculous story in such an unescapable way that, of course, the dad is going to be offended. The dad is going to be absolutely mad about what they've done with his son, as any father would. And that's why the people are gasping at the end. Now, that's not the only part of the gospel, because there are other gospel stories which explain an equally strong and equally paradoxical and equally perplexing drive that God loves people. The prodigal son is probably the one where the dad waits week after week until the son finally returns. So the exquisite challenge in the gospel is that you've got this tension of a God who is offended and a God who wants to help all at the same time and all with the intensity that only God can have. And the Christian message, and if you sort of want to argue some of this stuff out, I'm happy to chat afterwards, but much better to talk to the person in the pew next to you or in the seat next to you and ask them, what is this all about? How does this make sense? But there are three steps that the gospel offers to deal with that problem. It says, first of all, God came in Jesus. God becomes a man in Jesus, and he lives on earth. He dies for us, and he rises from the dead again for us. And Christians have just unpacked loads and loads of stuff from that. Some Christians are much bigger on the death of Jesus than the life of Jesus. It's interesting that when Paul goes to preach in Athens, they think he's got two gods because he's talking about Jesus and resurrection. And they think, well, these are two interesting gods, the one who comes back and the one who came. And of course, they've misunderstood, but that tells us something about the emphasis that Paul puts in that early message on the resurrection. But because Jesus has come and died and risen again, God can offer us a swap. And he can offer us Jesus' life in exchange for ours. And because of that, if we take that swap, we can be considered blameless before God. God can say, it's okay, I'm not offended anymore. He offers us a life, he offers us purpose, and he offers the prospect of glory ahead. Very briefly, that's what it is. And to make it work, the trouble is, if God forgives me for everything I've done up to this moment, that still gives me a problem with everything I'm going to do from now until the day I die. And God says, I've got an idea for that too. I'm going to come and live inside you. And that's what Christians believe, that God comes and lives inside us. And you look around this group and you say, well, there's not much evidence, is there, of God living inside of these people? And I would say, well, there are three things probably that I would say to you if that's your view looking around. One is, God hasn't finished with any of us. God is still working on our lives, and those lives are changing. Secondly, you haven't seen us 20 years ago. If you think I'm annoying now, you should have known me when I was 30 years younger. And that's the same with each one of us. God is moving us from one stage of glory to the next, and God is working in the people around. And the third thing I would say is, if you think that, you haven't looked hard enough. I've seen some amazing acts of kindness, of generosity, and of caring and other things by people in this church. And if you say there's not a lot of evidence of God living inside people, I would say look a little bit harder and try and find out stuff. Your criticisms may be true, right? There have been, I'm sure, great acts of selfishness and everything else by people in this place, but there are some wonderful acts that God is doing as well. And that's the message that we're trying to gossip about. So what happens if we try and share it? What happens if we try and talk to people about that story? What happens as we try and adapt it to meet the needs of people's lives every day? And as I was thinking about that, I thought about a story about something that happened to me in the last year. I was chairing a conference in London, and the group that had asked me to go there had arranged the transport to pick me up and take me in. And it wasn't the car service I normally use. I normally use a couple of people locally, and they're very good because they know exactly where I am, and they've never gotten me anywhere late. Anyway, this guy picks me up and he says, I think we'll stick clear of the motorway. We don't want to get stuck up in that traffic. Okay. And anyway, off we go. And about 45 minutes later, we're still clearing the back end of Heathrow as we head in on the A30. And I'm beginning to get some bad feelings about this. And in the end, I have to make several phone calls and they have to delay the start of the conference because I'm late in getting there. So it's an interesting sort of a conversation. And then as we go in, I start to talk to him and his story comes out. And one of the people, when they filled in the questionnaire from this place, said, we find it easy to talk to people when they're traveling. Somebody said, on a plane is a good place. And actually, Tim, where's Tim? Tim's got a really good story about something that happened to him on a plane when he got a chance to witness. People have been emailing me stories, and it's really interesting to see what God is doing in people's lives in this fellowship. Anyway, he starts to tell me about his life, and it's a really difficult life. And actually, I see lots of parallels between the decisions he's made in life and the decisions he's making as he makes his way into London and turns out to be late. And I'm thinking, you know, what is this guy all about? And I start to talk to him about, and we start to talk about, you know, whether he thinks he's going to see God one day, and he does. He thinks there's a God. He thinks he's going to meet him. And but it's, he'll leave everything until that moment. And I'm thinking, well, if you believe that you're going to see God one day, surely it's worth a bit of preparation. And then it strikes me as I'm talking to him that he doesn't prepare for anything in life. He's not somebody who prepares. He hasn't got a pension. You know, it's a really quite a sad case of this guy who's driving me in. And, you know, you get to the stage where he's not prepared for eternity because he's not even prepared for 4 or 5 years time in his life. How am I going to share anything meaningful with that guy? And I realized that a lot of my assumptions about what he would be interested in, a lot of the things in my lifestyle, I don't see myself as a particularly forward-looking person in terms of preparation. But, you know, because of the places I've worked, I do have a pension. Because of the things that go on, I do have to think ahead and do some preparing. But I'm on a different planet from this guy who's driving me in to London. And what would you do in after? It's taken me quite a long time to work out where he is. What are you going to offer that kind of a guy about faith and hope? Because he does want to know something. And in the end, all I could do was say, look, if you get a chance, here's the sort of church you might like to go for. And I said, just look for a church where there's lots of families going in. And that was about as far as I got with that. A complete waste of time, really, apart from the fact that it gives me a good illustration of how not to witness, really, on a Sunday morning. And so often, that's the way we feel, isn't it? We feel that we go so far, and then we don't get any further. And as I was emailing around earlier on in the year, somebody from Australia emailed me, and she said, Terry, you really should read I Once Was Lost. It's about sharing the gospel with people in the modern world. And so I bought it, and there's a copy, I've lent it to Andy, there's a copy sculling around that I'm happy for you to read. It says, stolen from Terry Young in the front, because I want it back one day, okay? So if you're the last person to have it, you know, I want it back. But it's a really, really good book. And one of the things that they're saying is, people are in different places. You have to work out where people are. And they've got 5 thresholds that they call for people to go over. So they say, there's a threshold. The person you're talking to may not know a single Christian that they even trust. And that may be their first step forward. And then there's, there's the question about whether they are curious about Christian things or whether they're indifferent. They may say, look, I trust you. It's your gospel. It works for you. But whatever. That doesn't matter to me. And they say that's often the next stage. And then there'll come a stage where they move from being closed to any kind of Christian experience to being open to it. And they tell a lot of stories. It's a really well-written book. It's worth reading. And then they say, even if they're open, they've got to make one more step before they can make progress. And that is, they've got to move from just meandering around to actually saying, I want to find out if this is true. I want to understand what's going on here. They've got some great stories about people who start to do that, and then they reach a point of decision. And there's a fantastic story in the book about somebody, and somebody felt really moved to go up and speak to him. And he said, you know, this was the last time I was going to come to church. If somebody didn't come if somebody didn't help me to bring this to a head in my life, I was going to give up on it completely. And he said, the final step is people have to take a step and become a follower of Jesus. And I found that quite a helpful way of looking at things. And it helps us to see that actually the times in which we fail in trying to share the gospel, all we've done is we've reached a threshold and we need to come back and start to pray about that some more. Last week, John suggested, there's a couple of slides here from John's talk, he suggested that Colossians 4 gives us 5 things to pray for. And he was linking them particularly to our witness. Pray, we should be watchful and thankful. We should be thankful in our jobs, in our work, in our people we meet, and we should be watchful for opportunities. We should pray that God will open doors for us. And I know that some people here do. They start out in the morning, God, open a door for me so that I can get some decent conversation going. Pray that we might proclaim it clearly. That's one of the things I really struggle with. You're suddenly in the situation and somebody wants a very clear, crisp answer, and a clear sort of clarity in Christmas just eludes you, don't they? They sort of evaporate. You think there is a good answer, but you're not able to come up with it on the spot. Make the most of every opportunity. And the thing about it is, if you start the opportunity, you can always trust God to turn it into something better. And always speak with grace. Be gracious in the way you share stuff. And one of the things that John was suggesting is that we pray for two people. Each of us pray for a couple of people that we know, and we make that a point of our prayer life. One of the things that people said was, actually, a lot of people I know come from very different cultures, and I don't even know what to say to them. And as I was thinking about that, I thought, I know this chap. His name isn't Stafford Allen. That's a pseudonym. He got converted in the Middle East when he was in the army. He came back to the UK. He trained as a doctor. He married a linguist. They went and worked in Sudan for a number of years, and she translated a chunk of the Bible into one of the Sudanese languages, and came back and worked in Birmingham as a GP, and he's written something called My Muslim Neighbor. And I like the book. I'll just leave a couple here at the front. I bought a load of them, and that allows me to give them away, especially since my house is full of books at the moment, because I haven't got storage space for enough stuff. So please, you'll be doing me a favor. But you must read it if you take it away. It's a really great book about just sharing the gospel informally without getting hung up on what the theology or the theological differences or anything like that is between you and another person. One of the things I like is he says, you don't know what your Muslim neighbor believes. You got to go and find out what they believe. We're going to finish with a couple of stories. One from Wayne and then one from Lorna about some narratives. These both stretch over quite a long period of time, and they've gone a little bit further than I managed to go with the cab driver.
Morning. 1985, so 34 years ago, I had a job in Maidenhead. I was working there. There was quite a number of other people working there. One of the guys who I worked with was a guy called Steve. And he worked in computers. I didn't work in computers. But at lunchtimes, we used to have lunch, play table tennis. After work on a Monday, we go down to the Magnet Leisure Centre, play football, etc., etc. So I got to know Steve. I was there for 3 years. I'm still in touch with him now. I do not ever remember having an opportunity or overtly sharing anything about Jesus with him. It wouldn't have been inappropriate, you know, if I'm on the phone to somebody and he's upstairs and I say, Steve, have you been washed in the blood of the Lamb? That doesn't go down too well. But there would have been other opportunities, so like when we were going for football tournaments, etc., or playing badminton or table tennis in the canteen. Anyway, to fast forward a bit, 3 years ago, April the 2nd, 2016, is a key date because April the 2nd is Joyce's birthday, but it's also a day when we were at Spring Harvest in Minehead. Steve was there with his wife, Lorraine, and his two children, Lizzie and Samuel. And I was doing some stuff with what they call distinctive, which is 11 to 13. Just was catching up with them. It was the final day, saying farewell. And then Steve said, Wayne, I've become a Christian. And I thought, wicked mum. It was just brilliant. And we're talking a number of years. Now, there would have been times, probably at his school, I think he was an ex-pupil at Desborough many years ago. There may have been other occasions, but it was on this one single occasion. He'd been to Spring Harvest a number of times with family and some from the church. And the morning that he actually responded to Jesus, Gavin Calver, who was here a few weeks ago, was speaking. And Steve just said, if you like, the penny dropped. 4 months later, Joyce and I, we went down to the West Country where he lives, and he was being baptised. And so I've known him for 30-odd years. Joyce has got to know him recently. And you could see, or Joyce said, that when he was sharing his story, his testimony, the difference that Jesus had made. An example of work. Now, obviously, it's not appropriate for us always at work to do stuff like that. But that last point that John made last week about with gentleness and with grace, 1 Peter 3:15 speaks to that. Be ourselves, whether it be in school or the workplace, or wherever, that can make a difference. That's one example of Steve, who's still going on with God all these years later.
Thanks ever so, Wayne.
Lorna, hi. Do you need a mic or? Thanks ever so. So Lorna wrote in again to me with a couple of stories, and we've picked out one of those. Is the mic on, Dan? Okay. And Lorna came back with a couple of stories, and she's just going to share one of them with you.
Thanks. Okay, so I wrote to Terry telling him about a long-term friend that I had. I've known her for over 40 years. We were at secondary school together, met her on the first day at secondary school, and were bosom buddies ever since. She knows my family very well. I'm from a Christian family, and has just sort of been on the periphery. You know, sort of, yeah, there's something going on, but don't quite get it, don't quite understand it, but very happy to be your friend and to support you in whatever you believe. So over the years, you know, life brings hardships, and she's been through tough times, I've been through tough times, but I think she's seen how the Lord has worked in my life and supported me and my family, and how much comfort I have received during difficult times. And she gets it, but she's a very good friend, but she's not someone you can push or challenge, really. You know, she's very strong views. So, you know, I've just invited her to different things. Some people here will see her quite regularly with me. She comes to Ladies Recharge, which she's very happy to do, but that's enough. And she's also had some difficult times, and then more recently, she's been a little bit more open to the Lord. And I'm really pleased to say that I was away earlier this year, and she messaged me while I was in Jamaica to actually say that she started going to her local Baptist church. And she don't quite get it, she says, but she knows there's something there, and she's willing to take that next step and just find out about things. So, you know, I think it's testament to the fact that you can just be there, be yourself, you know, show your love for the Lord, and, you know, eventually, as 40 years, something's working in her life. You know, I don't think she's quite there yet, but I will encourage her anyway. So that's my story.
Thanks very much, Lorna.